You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Good morning. It is 6:06 right now. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, Civic Media Mornings. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And good morning. I'm Brian Noonan. Good to be with you again. Another big show with a lot to talk about. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore will join us in the second hour, and we're going to talk a little Puppy Bowl. We got a lot to get to. And oh, man, if your child is on the UW campus, guess what? So are the measles. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to all of that. But we like to start with some stories that you might admit they're important, but in this storm of stupidity that seems to be coming at us nonstop, some stories get missed, and that is our job to dig them out. And by our job, I mean Jamie always digs deep and finds some things that we...
I try.
You do. And this one, everybody was paying attention to because Kristi Noem opened her mouth again and things fell out.
Something fell out. But she now says that all DHS officers operating in Minneapolis are going to be wearing body cameras effective immediately.
Did she say they'd be working or
well,
just they're
no,
like
we did not specify
Lego
on
body
the facts.
Cams.
That's right. We did not specify the facts. But she says that there are plans to expand the program nationwide as funding allows, meaning that probably a little dig at the bill that's hung up right now as the partial government shutdown continues.
How about they cut the bonuses back from 50 grand, the signing bonus, to maybe 25, and then all of a sudden you've freed up all that money for body cams.
Think of what
Fixed.
You could do with
Look
that.
Look at me. I should be on some sort of a committee.
Fixing the budget here right on the morning show. It's amazing.
So within 30 seconds. That's how easy it is, actually.
Right. So the move actually follows renewed scrutiny on immigration enforcement tactics after the shooting of Alex Preddy in late January and also Renee Good just a couple weeks before that. Investigators reviewed footage from more than 30 body cameras to piece together what happened. Weirdly, have you seen that footage?
No, I have not.
Okay. All right. Because when I read that last night and I was putting this together, I was like, wait, there was actually body cam footage from 30 different views that was pieced together?
I'm guessing it was not flattering then, if they're not, because knowing Kristi Noem and this administration, they would have been out there banging
right.
the drums to say, look at this
right.
is why we had to do what we did.
I'm glad that you said that because I thought I missed something in the process. So I
nope.
okay. So advocates, of course, have been pushing for DHS officers, including ICE and Customs and Border Protection, to wear these body cameras, noting that officers have sometimes relied on personal cell phones to record encounters. We actually saw that with the mm-hmm. Renee Good shooting. President Trump said he left the decision to Noem, calling body cameras generally beneficial for law enforcement. The announcement comes as Congress debates a short-term extension of DHS funding. Democrats are pressing for limits on ICE operations. Some Republicans, including Wisconsin's own Ron Johnson, are signaling support for body-worn cameras, even as broader immigration disputes remain unresolved, I should say.
And Ron Johnson is also against judicial warrants. He just
mm-hmm.
wants them to have a piece of paper, anybody, you
right.
know. You write up your own warrant. I'll be honest. I agree with body cams for
yes.
all law enforcement, not just federal. And it is, and we chuckled a little, it is for protection of not only the citizens, but it is for the protection of the officers, too. So because eyewitness testimony, not reliable at all.
Right.
We're seeing, citizen recordings are really proving helpful, but I think they should always have body cameras.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's your county sheriff or ICE.
Agreed. And in this particular case, though, I'll be honest, I'm a little skeptical because the question...
Oh, I don't believe there's footage.
No, the question isn't whether DHS officers wear the cameras. I mean, obviously, we joked a little bit about that. It's whether the administration can be trusted to release the footage. We just talked about that as well, right?
Right.
There's footage that's apparently been pieced together that I haven't seen, you haven't seen, and probably a good majority of our listeners have no idea what that is either. And there's also, you know, there's also going to be another incident involving ICE agents. Let's be realistic. We know that with the fact that they continue to push these ICE agents into these cities, there's going to be another incident. And really, transparency is only going to matter if the public actually gets to see the evidence, if it's not being locked away or selectively disclosed for just certain eyes to see. To me, it's going to be bogus.
Yeah, and I sound more and more pessimistic and skeptical every day, but I don't trust that this administration, even if there is footage, would not edit it. I mean, they're really big at redacting stuff.
Right.
So I don't foresee it coming out and, you know, just roll the footage, right. Let us all see it. It's not going to happen.
This is also fairly politically convenient for this administration because, as we mentioned, let's be honest, they're trying to get the government back open. Donald Trump would like the Republicans, we'll talk about this in just a little bit, would like the Republicans to actually negotiate with the Democrats to open things back up. But, you know, that spending bill is basically hung up because of protections for citizens and less funding for ICE and DHS. And so this feels a little politically, you know, motivated and maybe convenient at this given time. But we shall see. Again, I'm all for body cams. I think that they're important for many, many reasons. I don't trust this administration to actually do the right thing with them. That's it.
Well, in the saga of Bill and Hillary Clinton and the threats of being held in contempt of Congress, the Clintons have decided that they will come for in-person depositions, and that way they will not be they will avoid the contempt vote in the Jeffrey Epstein case. Why? It's funny. I didn't see anybody else being called in, but Bill Clinton is being called in.
Isn't that weird? You know, it's so weird how that works. I appreciated is House Oversight Chair James Comer says that the offer that the Clintons have made still lacks clarity, including firm dates, and he's not yet said whether he's going to accept it. Democrats on the committee argue the Clintons. Democrats on the committee are arguing that Clintons have agreed to all previously requested terms and expect the depositions to move forward. The offer was sent during a committee meeting as Republicans were preparing contempt proceedings after months of stalled negotiations. Comer had rejected earlier proposals for voluntary interviews instead of sworn depositions. If accepted, this agreement could avert a full House vote on contempt, which could carry legal consequences for the former president and the former Secretary of State.
I know this is a very simplistic statement or a question, but I thought, and Jamie, we're going to have a civics lessons from you later, so I figure you are the person I can ask this, and I know the answer, but I want to get it out. I thought the law was supposed to apply equally to everyone. Am I the most naive creature on the planet?
No, in fact, there's many parts of our Constitution on the national level and in our state level that would imply just that, that, you know, these rules should basically, you know, be applied to everyone. You know, here's what I would say, though, about this. If Comer thinks that the Clintons offer lacks some clarity, maybe that's because they also see this as a bit of a sham. Now, I wouldn't dream of imagining what the Bill and Hillary Clinton are thinking. But if we think it's a sham, you know, this is a woman who was dragged into, as the former Secretary of State, dragged into congressional hearings for 11 hours and testified on Benghazi, right? So, you know, they kind of understand how this wheel works. And if they're seeing it this way, I can't imagine, you know.
And as a reminder, the Clintons had originally said they would come in and testify, but they wanted the hearings open.
Right.
Open to the public. And once again, transparency and this administration are at, they are diametrically opposed.
That's right. And, you know, there besides the president, several of his cabinet members were also named in this latest batch of the Epstein files. So if you're going to drag...
Are they being called in?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. I mean, it feels like there's a little bit of a discrepancy as to who's coming in to actually answer the questions. But... you know, what do we know? I mean, we just solved the budget in like 30 seconds, but, you know, what do we know?
We know what's happening. We know what we see. We know what other people see, and everyone knows what they see. It's if you choose to see it or if you choose to ignore it,
right,
or excuse it. And that's because in the end, we're all seeing the exact same thing. It's how it is being interpreted by each individual mind.
Yes. And for the Republicans, that's a completely different level of truth than the rest of us have as to what's actually happening on multiple different layers, not only Epstein files, but when you look at what's happening in Minneapolis with the shootings, there's multiple levels of truth. And it doesn't seem like they're maybe existing in the real level, and they have they're alternate universes. That's what it feels like sometimes when you read the news headlines.
And it comes from the top. If you have to create an alternate reality because every time an election, everything is not real. There's always an excuse. There's always, whatever here happened in the real world, that's not, you know, I'm closing the Kennedy Center for renovation. Oh, you're not closing it because no tickets are being sold and everybody's canceling? No.
And the guy you just put in charge 2 weeks ago already stepped down because the job is so impossible. No, we don't need to talk about that. Let's just say that we need to make it Liberace's second home. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. That's what's happening
too much
here.
Gold. I started paying attention to this story yesterday, and it is so weird. You know, Savannah Guthrie from NBC, her mom is missing and continues to be missing. They realized when she didn't show up for church on Sunday. Now, they're very adamant that I think her mom is 88. 84. But they keep pushing that, you know, she's not, there's no cognitive issues. This is not a woman who's confused and just wandered off. It is so strange.
It is really strange. And I actually watched Savannah Guthrie's plea on the Today Show yesterday of her talking about this and, you know, asking for help in finding her mom. And you just really, anytime you have anybody in your world that's missing or, you know, who you just don't have answers to, it's hard. And so I just really felt for Savannah Guthrie. And the Pima County Sheriff, because this is taking place in Arizona, that's where her mom lives, has described the scene at the house as very concerning. And homicide detectives have actually been called in. There was blood found at the house. And so they are thinking that there is something that happened in this particular case and that this woman did not leave her house by her own will, which is
even stranger.
Well, yeah, because
her wallet, her cell phone, the car, her car, everything was still at the house.
Yes, yes. And now they are saying there's no threat to the public in the area. But obviously, at this point in time, the Pima County Sheriff's Department is urging anybody who has information to come forward because Nancy Guthrie is missing. And so it's just, it's one of those stories that, you know, at first seemed a little under the radar. And then as the course of yesterday just kept, it just kept escalating. And all of a sudden we got to this point where about a half hour ago, we found out that there was blood at the scene of at her home. So,
and it's, you know, the house, you don't just walk away from this house. It's out, it's kind of in the desert. It's a beautiful home, but it's surrounded by tumbleweeds and desert.
It's desert.
So it's not... Yeah, it's not like, oh, this is, I'm going into town.
Right.
Just walking. No, you got to take the car if you're leaving the house.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. I mean, as you mentioned, everything was there, including the vehicle. Everything is still there. So it's going to be interesting, but hopefully they find her safe and sound because that's all you really want in these types of stories or these cases. At 84, I think, you know, the natural instinct for everybody was like, oh, she's a little bit older. She's, you know, needs some medicine too. So they're worried about the health conditions with the whole thing. So hopefully it works out. It is 6:19 right now. You're listening to Civic Media Mornings. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. When we come back, we'll talk about the funding deal and the president wanting everybody to get along. Good luck. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Mm-hmm.
It's 6:22 right now. We hope that your morning is going well so far. If you're listening in Oshkosh or Appleton on WISS, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And if you're in the La Crosse area, you're probably listening on WLCX. We also welcome you to the show. This is Civic Media Mornings on the Civic Media Radio Network. I am Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Good morning. We mentioned it earlier, but we're going to delve a little deeper. The president and other top Republicans really want to talk to Democrats and stop the conservative revolt that is happening over this funding bill. They want, I revolt may be a little strong, but I think, you know.
Hey, if they can use adjectives, so can we.
Sure, exactly. So we got to, because the government is closed. I don't know if you've noticed, it's only been, it was closed over the weekend. Government's usually closed over the weekend, at least government offices. We don't pay that much attention. How many of us really in years, decades past, you know, knew what that meant if the government closed down? You're like, well, the post office closed on President's Day. I don't know.
What I was surprised about is even with a partial government shutdown, Congress was actually working yesterday. This is usually prime Speaker Mike Johnson sending everybody home kind of territory. So I was shocked that they were working yesterday, quite honestly.
He must have got the word from the top because, yeah, last time he shut it down. He didn't bring anybody back. He didn't swear people in. Mike Johnson, he's a piece of work.
I've
got to ask Gwen Moore about Mike Johnson to see if if the public persona matches the real man. I guess I'll put it diplomatically.
What I appreciate about Gwen Moore, and she'll be joining us after 7:30 this morning, is she's usually honest in her responses. So it should be a very interesting answer that we would get from the Congresswoman. But it is interesting because, you know, when it comes to Mike Johnson, he's scrambling a little bit right now to secure the votes in what is a pretty divided GOP as Senate Republican leaders urge House members to pass this budget deal without adding any new demands. And the president himself is making personal calls, because he usually does. I don't know why this is surprising to anybody. To House Republicans, pressing them to support the bill with no changes in order to avoid a prolonged shutdown. Now, there's some conservative hardliners involved in this, though, led by Florida Republican Anna Paulina Luna. They're pushing to attach a strict voter ID requirement, a move that would actually derail a key procedural vote and stall this bill entirely. Johnson has rejected that idea. Those two don't always see eye to eye, so it's interesting when those two go head to head. But he is warning that adding this measure would jeopardize reopening the government. And this proposed deal includes a short-term extension of DHS funding. It's paired with a broader full-year spending package, creating space for negotiations over Democratic demands to rein in ICE practices. Democrats also remain a bit divided. You got party leadership who doesn't really want to help the Republicans advance this bill. Progressives are firmly opposed to any additional funding for ICE. And then you have some senior Democrats who have signaled some support. And let's remember, the GOP has a razor-thin majority. Johnson can't lose anybody in this particular vote if he wants this bill to actually succeed, which is also going to make it very, very interesting over the next few days.
I can't see it. Well, I shouldn't say that. I can't see it passing with no changes. I think there are a couple of Republicans who are going to say, no, we've got to pump the brakes on ICE and DHS. They have money to operate right now. Pull that out. I'm going to fix everything in 30 seconds. Take that part out. Take that funding bill out, or that funding out of the bill. Mm-hmm. Everybody seems to, unless you're a hardliner on the right, want to have more discussion regarding DHS and ICE funding. Take it out, let them vote on the rest of it, and then take the 2 weeks, friends. Oh, it's 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Everything's 2 weeks with these guys. But it's not going to pass with no changes.
No.
There's got to be enough. Somebody on the Republican side of that House has to have the sense to look at this country and listen, they read the polls as well as we do.
Right.
And while we don't put 100% stock in those, they know what their constituents are saying. They're getting the calls to their office. Their staffers are going, oh, my God, we are being inundated with angry constituents.
Well, and when you talk about the polls, I mean, the last government shutdown was deeply unpopular with even GOP voters. And so Republicans were really able to pin the blame on the Democrats like they wanted to last go around. So it feels like if you're trying to repeat that strategy, especially in a midterm election, that's only going to risk further damage to their standing with the public. And we mentioned that razor-thin majority. Now, I want to remind everybody that Democrats just won a special election in Texas over the weekend. Speaker Mike Johnson says that that new member is most likely going to be sworn in this week. Now, I think that's fascinating because the last time there was a special election and there was a new member who needed to be sworn in, by the way, we were waiting for the Epstein files and they needed that final signature, they wouldn't swear her in. Do we all remember how that played out? Weeks and weeks the poor woman had to wait. And we were told it was because there was a government shutdown and that we couldn't possibly do it during a shutdown. But the Epstein files are now been released. It's fine. We can move along procedurally now. It's fine.
Yes, because as the argument went, and it was a legal argument, people had been sworn in during shutdowns in the past. Mike Johnson decided this for, and it's supposition, of course, Jamie. We don't know the truth, but it seemed convenient that the one signature that would have forced the release of the Epstein files was kept out. But
I don't know. I like convenient
truths. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Now we just have to deal with more victim blaming and victim shaming and, the DOJ just seeming to act in a kind of a retribution style toward the accusers and the victims.
What I love, though, is even when something should be essentially as simple, and I get nothing in government is simple, but when it comes to funding the government, we can't even manage to do that correctly right now, right? Nope. Like, we can't even manage to do that correctly. We can't get it done for the people who are without jobs. We just sit and wait. That's what we're going to keep doing. Yeah. So I wouldn't hold my breath that this gets done in the next couple days. And we'll talk with Gwen Moore. We'll get her take on it later. Yeah. 6:29 right now. You're listening to Civic Media Mornings. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. We'll talk to Rachel Dion Thunder about grassroots movements after this on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Listening to Civic Media Mornings on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thank you so much for joining us. We do hope your day is off to a great start. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Good morning. We've all been watching with great interest the protests, the demonstrations in Minneapolis after the murder of Alex Pretty. And it's amazing to me, and we've just said this before, how many people are showing up. And it's grassroots movements that are doing this. I'm always amazed how those movements come together, how these protests get the word out, how they get people here. One of the groups that's been very instrumental in these protests is the Indigenous Protector Movement. Rachel Dion Thunder is the co-founder and vice president of IPM. She's also a community organizer, an environmental scientist, and an advocate for Indigenous sovereignty and justice, and she joins us now. Rachel, thanks for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'll just say Tonseg and Anaskamolten and Anaskamolten, Upsis and Nahiawak, Upsis Rachel Dion Thunder. So I just greeted everybody listening and thanked everybody in my language. I'm Plains Cree, Nihio, Nihiawak, Big Stone Cree Nation, Treaty 8. Thanks for having me on.
That's great. And for those of us, and I apologize, who aren't familiar, where was the Cree Nation? Where was their original lands?
So our people are still on our original lands. It's a lot of it is in Alberta and Saskatchewan and Canada. Okay. So, yeah, my tribe is in northern Alberta.
Very nice.
So let's start with telling us a little bit, Rachel, about what IPM is and what you guys do. What is the mission of this organization?
Yeah, so IPM is we started grassroots and really all of us that are co-founders are second generation American Indian Movement or AIM. And so for folks that don't know what AIM is, AIM was a Native American civil rights movement that started in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1968. So my dad was a part of AIM. One of our executive director, Crow Belcourt, he's the son of Clyde Belcourt, which was one of the co-founders of the American Indian Movement. And the American Indian Movement was originally founded to protect our people from police brutality in Minneapolis. And so what we have done with the Indigenous Protector Movement is really just continued on that work of the original American Indian movement in Minneapolis. A lot of the work that we do is combating police brutality, standing up for Indigenous rights, a lot of environmental injustices. So that's the kind of work that we do. And so we already had some patrols in place, like AIM Patrol and Mini Shields, which is some community safety patrols in South Minneapolis. We've been running those for years. And so when Metro Surge started in Minneapolis, we already had those structures in place to be able to respond rapidly. And I know there's a lot of folks listening, you know, like in Wisconsin right now, and now's the time to start building those structures in your own community, because that's how we were able to deploy legal observers and patrols on our streets during this occupation by the federal government in Minneapolis. So having that system in place, having those collaborations already in place with other grassroots groups and organizations that do the same work, establishing those networks is really powerful. People, now is the time for people to be proactive in their communities where ICE activity is not there currently.
Well, Rachel, that's an interesting point. So how do these communities that might be listening today and saying, you know what, she makes a good point, we do need to start getting ready. What's the steps? How do you go about getting those organizations? You said you guys started with community safety patrols. Walk us through getting things to a point where then you can network with other groups.
Right. So it really just starts with being a good neighbor and being a kind person, being a loving person, wanting to help your community. And so every community is different. So look at what's going on in your community. Look at where there's niches or needs currently being unmet and see how you can fill those gaps. And so a lot of that here in Minneapolis started with like environmental justice work that we were doing, and then tapping in with other groups that were doing the same work. And social media is such a powerful tool that like older generations, you know, didn't have. And so now, you know, you can do a quick Google search. You can search on Facebook. You can search on Instagram and find really quickly other groups of individuals, grassroots groups and organizations that have the same interests as you. And so it's really easy to tap into those networks. And, you know, like a big part of what we're doing right now is like mutual aid work. So like we're taking a lot of donations, like food, PPE, you know, safety equipment, gas cards, all of those things, and then distributing them out to community, because there's a lot of families that are scared right now, right? Like there's a lot of families that are scared to go to work, that are scared to send their kids to school, that are scared to go to the grocery store. And, you know, being able to fill those gaps to make, you know, our neighbors, our most vulnerable, feel safe, those people that have those needs, and how do we meet those needs? And so, you know, it's different for every community. And we just looked at the needs that were not being met in Minneapolis, and we started organizing. That's all it takes. You know, that's the hardest step. A lot of times, you know, when you look at this work, you're like, okay, well, all these families need food. And, you know, I've got 520 families that are reaching out saying that they need food. That seems overwhelming. The hardest thing is to get started. And so once you get started, there's just a momentum to it. There's a spirit to it. People want to do good. People want to help each other. And if you can create the system that people can plug into to help each other, the people show up. That's the beautiful thing about what's going on right now, is just how community is showing up for one another every single day. You know, Peggy Flanagan, yesterday we had a ceremony at Powwow Grounds, which is a Native coffee shop on Franklin Avenue, the Native American Cultural Corridor in Minneapolis. And, you know, she said, you know, I'm exhausted, but I'm not tired. And so that's the general feeling here. Like, we're all dog bone exhausted, but our spirits aren't tired.
We're talking with Rachel Dion Thunder. She is the co-founder of Indigenous Protector Movement out of Minneapolis. She's a community organizer, an environmental scientist, and an advocate for Indigenous sovereignty and justice. Now, Rachel, I do want to ask you, how do movements like what we saw in Minneapolis with Ice Out build out solidarity across different groups? Because not only was your group involved in this through the Indigenous the Indigenous community, but there were faith communities who were involved in this sort of organization, labor organizers and others. So how are you building that type of solidarity among those different groups?
So, I mean, it kind of goes back to what I was saying before. You know, people are seeing these injustices and activating in their groups that they already had. So, like, you know, obviously labor unions have existed for a long time. And so they were able to activate quickly and draw a lot of folks in to their network. And a lot of us that do this work kind of just know each other from other causes or other injustices. And that's where a lot of the collaboration happens. But it also doesn't, you know, just because you don't know somebody doesn't mean that you don't show up. And that's a big part of it, is just showing up. You know, look at who's doing food banks. Look at who is planning a march. Look at who is doing mutual aid deliveries to folks in your community, and just reach out, just show up, just say, hey, I want to volunteer. And then that's how you start, you know, just get to know everybody, get to know their names, and just see how you can plug in. And there's lots of different ways for people to plug in. You know, movements are not just protests or actions. It takes all of our gifts, all of our skills, like even you guys, right? Like, look at the platform that you have here on this radio show. Like, that is your tool. That is your gift, is sharing the story and sharing this information out to people. You know, we need grant writers. We need people who can do communications and write press releases. We need people who can run dispatches from their houses. We need people that can deliver food. We don't necessarily need everybody on the front lines. There's lots of ways for people to plug in and to be a part of a movement. And that's what makes a movement beautiful.
Are you finding that this, what's happened over the last few weeks in Minneapolis, seems to be galvanizing more than the quote unquote usual suspects of people who were demonstrating and protesting? When you tell people that you need all these diverse kinds of talents to come together, have you noticed more people from all sorts of, with, well, I can't stand in a protest line, but I can do this? Are more people like that coming into the movements?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of people that have never done frontline work are now on the front lines. And, you know, we're running a hub out of Powwow Grounds Coffee Shop and All My Relations Gallery, right there on Franklin Avenue. And we have so many folks just showing up like, hey, I'm here. I'm not working today. How can I help? And that's what it takes. That's how we build these movements. And we do have a lot of folks, you know, it's not necessarily like frontline younger people. Like, we've got grandmas, we've got grandpas, we've got moms, dads come in, you know, in after work and after school is out, you know, showing up with the kids. And that's really what community is. You know, we're building these connections, these real connections, not through a phone, not through social media, but face to face, you know, just out of kindness and love for each other and for our city and for our neighbors.
Rachel, what message would you like people outside of Minnesota and, you know, anybody listening today here in Wisconsin or maybe on our app or through our streaming platforms to understand about why these movements and what is happening in this groundwork in Minneapolis is so important and why it matters so much, especially in these moments?
You know, if we think about strategically what this administration is trying to do, you know, they're testing how far they can push communities, because they came to Minnesota with a strategy, right? They came to Minnesota to try and see how far they could push the line. And I think it's important right now to support Minnesota, but you know, to also prepare your own community. Sorry, I'm getting an oil change. I have to keep my truck ready to go on patrol.
And she multitasks.
That's it.
Hold on. Yeah, if you could just check my tire pressure. Okay, thank you. Sorry, guys.
Oh, no worries.
No worries.
Yeah. You know, they came to Minnesota to try to prove a point. They came to a Democratic state. They came, you know, to a state where the governor was running on the presidential platform with Kamala Harris. They came to a state that has never voted for Trump. And they came here heavily militarized and violent. And I believe that they came here to see how far they can push people, see how far they can push communities, see how far they can get away with things, and also see how far they can press our electeds and our democracy, you know, because right now it's like, what can our electeds do to actually get ICE out of Minnesota? And not only ICE out of Minnesota, but defund ICE and dismantle ICE, you know, because we don't want ICE anywhere in the country.
No. Rachel, we're up against the break, but we appreciate your time today. Keep up the good work. People can go to indigenousprotectormovement.com to get all the information. Rachel Dion Thunder is the co-founder and vice president of Indigenous Protector Movement. Rachel, thanks so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. It is Civic Media Mornings, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
It's 6:52 right now. We hope that your morning is going well so far. Bright and early and, you know, a little movement already in downtown Madison. If you want to join the conversation today, remember, you can always call or text us, 1-855-752-4842. That's 1-855-75-CIVIC. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. You caught me in mid-yawn. Good morning.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Listen, that happens
to
everybody who's, listen, I'm awake, I'm caffeinated, I'm ready to roll, I'm nervous. Because another measles case has popped up in Wisconsin. This right down the street, Jamie, on the UW-Madison campus. A student has contracted measles. That was according to an email that was sent out to the school community yesterday. Second case of measles in Wisconsin this year. Not promising.
No, it's
again for the let's not vaccinate crowd.
Right. And this student was exposed during some international travel, and health officials from the Department of Health Services say that this case is not connected to a measles case that was reported just last week in Waukesha County, which was also travel related.
Yes.
Now, this particular student, we do know, lives off campus and is recovering after receiving medical care. The student did visit several locations on and around campus, though, while infectious.
Oh.
And so if you're in the Madison area, take note, because those locations include the Qdoba on Park Street, a psychology building, the Wiseman Center, and the Genetics and Biotechnology Center, as well as Union South. Measles, by the way, is highly contagious, just in case anybody's wondering.
But the good news is, if you've been vaccinated, then you don't have to quarantine. This is all coming from the official email from UW-Madison. You should watch yourself if you were in any of these places in the last week or so. Look for symptoms like a high fever, cough, runny nose, and red, watery eyes, which sounds like every morning for me. But if you have not been vaccinated and you were in these places, and I don't think this will matter when we tell you you're supposed to quarantine for 21 days after the date of exposure. But if you're not getting vaccinated, you're probably not going to quarantine either.
Right.
Because your concern for public health is probably pretty low.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. And that's me talking and science.
Right. I go to people like Brian, who's been an educator, right? Especially working in classrooms with small kids, right? They touch everything. Yes. Everything hits the hands. They want hugs. They want kisses. They want all of that. They're little germ machines.
They're oscillating sprinklers of filth.
Yes.
That's all they are.
They really, really, truly are. So I always go to my educator friends when it comes to whether or not people should vaccinate. And I'm not going to tell you what you need to do with your own family. I get that. People have got to make their own choices. But at the same time, it's a matter of public health. And when you're talking about educators and people trying to have your children in classrooms, you know, like I have plenty of friends who've been in your shoes, still do what you used to do.
Yes.
And I know every year they just kind of brace for that moment when the first kid sneezes.
The first case of the flu, even a cold. Mm-hmm. I've had pink eye outbreaks, head lice outbreaks, flu, all of it. And you know, I understand we don't want to tell people what to do, but in some cases, people need to be told what to do. There's a reason that measles was almost gone. There's a reason that these vaccines are 97% effective, because we get them and we are protected. And yes, maybe the government is telling you what to do, but you know what? That same government is also telling somebody else what to do to protect your kids. So if you have any self-awareness, any concept of living in a society, it makes sense that you wouldn't want your children getting sick and you wouldn't want to make other children sick. And guess what? There's a good chance that you were vaccinated by your parents and you didn't get sick. So while I you're very magnanimous to not tell people what to do, sometimes I want to grab collars, just do it.
I won't say I agree, and I definitely...
Oh, I know you didn't agree.
But I will say that if that's the choice you're going to make, I guess you live with those consequences.
But then keep your kids at home.
Right. Yes.
And you stay at home, and you don't get to be part of society. If you're not willing to make any sacrifice for the betterment of society, you don't deserve to be part of
society.
But
you bring up a really good point. It's the self-awareness, right? And how many people, and I don't say this might be a generality, and I don't mean to generalize, but
Please do.
The same time, how many people do you see walking around in this world right now who have no absolute care or self-awareness for anybody else anywhere?
Please. Everybody walks around like they're toddlers with no body awareness.
Yes.
They have no idea that another human being is in front of them, behind them, next to them.
They
just
don't care.
Like a toddler or a drunk. Drunks and toddlers are very similar as well.
Yeah.
They're just stumbling about, banging into things.
This is very true.
Gibberish coming out of their heads. And it's how, there is no self-awareness. There is no, and it's because... And it was happening before the pandemic.
Of course.
We can't blame everything on the pandemic.
Well, a lot of it can.
People were isolating before. Once the internet came along and cell phones and video games, you had a lot of people who became insular. And once you are insular, you forget that there's people outside of your little bubble and you have to exist outside of your bubble.
I know it's hard. I know it's hard because you get into your social media world, and I get that it's hard to actually leave the house and interact with humans in a way that needs to happen in order to
touch grass, Jamie. That's what the kids say in the boy aquarium.
Right.
You
gotta
touch
grass.
They go, Brian, get
that's
out, touch
important.
Some grass. And I said, did you say grass or... All right, I will.
Yes, Brian. Jeez.
You know, in light of this conversation, I do just want to remind everybody that Florida's Surgeon General basically just lifted all mandates on vaccines.
Then if you
Florida.
Don't want to vaccinate, everybody should move to Florida. And we'll chop it off, let it float away like a big Petri dish out in the middle of the ocean.
Take care of yourselves out there, people.
And take care of each other.
That's right. Don't live in your bubble. It's 6:59 right now. You are listening to Civic Media Mornings. I'm Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Civics Lesson after the news on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.